appreciate you letting me be part of your listening day as we broadcast in full view of the gorgeous Elliott Bay, which we will soon be able to see. still a little dark, but it stays lighter later at night. All right. Boy, do we have a lot of ground we have to cover. Is Donald Trump going to be arrested tomorrow? Apparently not. Apparently Donald Trump will not be arrested tomorrow. He might be arrested later this week, and he's making everything he can of this. This is a fascinating, I'm not going to say a fascinating case, just a fascinating topic for both legal and political reasons. Legally speaking, the case against Trump is trash. And I will tell you why a little bit later on. But politically speaking, think about this now. Does it help or hurt Donald Trump as a candidate for the Republican nomination to be arrested by a hyper-partisan, liberal New York DA? Again, he's running for the Republican nomination on the grounds that the system is rigged against people who believe the things he believes. So does this hurt him to people? Oh, my God, the guy's tarbrushed. The guy's being indicted. The guy's being accused of a crime. Get away from him. Or does it inspire a backlash? That's going to be very interesting to unpack, and we will later on this morning here on the John Carlson Show. 7 years ago, a new law went into place in Seattle to address the scourge of gun violence. That law was a tax on the sale of every new firearm, $25 tax if you buy a firearm in Seattle. And not only that, it was 5 cents for every centerfire cartridge, 5 cent tax for every shotgun shell, 2 cents for every rimfire cartridge. In other words, a tax on ammo and a tax on guns. It was supposed to raise about $400,000 to $500,000 a year. But more important than that, it was supposed to address the issue of gun violence. We'll take a look at the numbers here a little later on this show. Also, if you earn $100,000 in the city of Seattle, what's it really worth? The smartasset.com company conducted a study of the 67 largest cities and ranked them in terms of where $100,000 goes farthest when it comes to taxes and inflation and where it doesn't go very far. We'll tell you where the city of Seattle ranked. Also, how to tell if your wife or mother is a racist. At 7:04, we will tell you the telltale signs of how to tell if your wife or mother is a racist.
And we have already determined, from what you told me off the air before the show, that my wife is probably a racist.
I think
so we'll see where this goes.
I think she needs some.
Yeah. I mean, what's the remedy for this if indeed this is the determination for what is and is not racist?
I think after the show, you need to conduct an intervention. I think there needs to be an intervention. Consciousness raising.
Yeah. So, Phil, you're going to go home. How was your day, honey? Uh-huh. Well, let me tell you, my beautiful wife, we need to talk.
honey, how you doing? Great. And listen, honey, I just found out I mean, no big deal, but you're a racist.
As it pertains to what you're going to explain, I will give the caveat.
It is a big deal.
I'm guessing at least 50% of the listening audience is probably in this category as racist, based on the criteria that you have uncovered.
Philip J. tells the uncomfortable truth, but, you know, we need to start addressing these uncomfortable truths in this systemically racist land of ours.
Get comfortable.
Your wife or mother is probably a racist, and we'll tell you why.
Get comfortable.
At 7:05.
Being uncomfortable, right?
Okay. Before we get there, I know normally I like to start local. Today I want to start national, because it's a national story with a great local angle. Do you guys ever watch Shark Tank?
Occasionally. Okay. Sure.
I have, but maybe for about 45 seconds at a time as I was getting ready to change the channel.
Okay, Shark
Tank.
But
I'm familiar with the show. Yeah. Very familiar with the show.
Shark Tank is a show where young entrepreneurs, or maybe not so young, new entrepreneurs of all ages who have ideas for what'll be the next big thing appear in front of four, sometimes five, very successful business people. Oftentimes that list includes the woman who started the Shopping Channel, Mark Cuban, who owns the Dallas Mavericks and is a famous economic contrarian, and Kevin O'Leary, who has nickname Mr. Wonderful, a Canadian entrepreneur who's been fabulously successful. All these people are billionaires. And Kevin O'Leary was making an appearance on the CNN morning show. Now, I bring this to your attention knowing that none of you have seen this interview because it was on CNN in the morning. And unless you were stuck in an airport late last week, and, you know, we're stuck watching CNN, you probably did not see this. Anyway, the thing about the Shark Tank show is they decide that they will tell the entrepreneurs whether or not their product has a chance of succeeding, and then they'll actually make an investment pitch. But sometimes all of them say, no, your idea is half-baked. It's just not ready. And it's a very intriguing, very interesting show. So Kevin O'Leary's become famous less for being an investment genius, which he is, than for being a very quotable member of the Shark Tank panel. And so he was appearing with Poppy Harlow and Don Lemon, who I guess is off probation. And this is what he told them. He said that there are some states that he will simply refuse to invest in. Are you surprised what states that he mentioned? Have a listen.
I don't put companies here in New York anymore, or in Massachusetts, or in New Jersey, or in California. Those states are uninvestable. The policy here is insane. The taxes are too high. We put them in Fargo, North Dakota, because 40% of the people work elsewhere, including Boston. So I was, you know, of a bit of a debate with Elizabeth Warren about this, but I say, look, Senator, we've got to move the companies out of your state because you're not investable anymore. You're punishing people if they're successful. You overtax them. You hit them with a super tax. New Jersey, what a mess. New York, uninvestable.
And wait, California. Why is New York uninvestable?
Try and do a project in New York. Try and build a data.
Yeah, I'm asking, Don's point, is it beyond the taxes?
Oh, the regulatory environment is punitive. I had a project in upstate New York behind the grid in Niagara Falls for electricity, a global data center we were building. Eventually, it got so bad with the politicians in the local region and the state policy, we moved it to Norway and all the jobs. Norway has it now. Thousands of jobs coming out of that. I mean, that's New York, uninvestable. Sorry, don't shoot the messenger, just telling you the way it is.
New York, California, New Jersey. Did he mention Illinois as well? He may have mentioned Illinois. Why wouldn't Washington State soon qualify for that list? We're going down the same path. The only thing that has saved this state from ending up with massive unfunded liabilities like Illinois, massive dislocation, people leaving the state of Washington in droves like they are California and like they are New York. The only thing that is keeping them is the success of companies that are regularly being demonized and attacked by the politicians who are making the state a lousy place to live. I hear it all the time. People say, I just love the beauty of Washington State. But it's just not what it was, and I don't see it getting better, so I'm thinking of moving. And these are not, you know, people in their 70s, for crying out loud, who are looking for a place to retire. These are oftentimes young people thinking about their future. Where do I want to put down stakes with my family and grow our future? Why wouldn't this apply to Washington? The regulatory environment is awful. I mean, just to give one example, just one quick example, housing. The politicians who have made affordable housing unaffordable with taxation and with regulation and with restrictions are now pounding the table that they need to raise taxes, they need to raise bonding authority so that the government can build new housing and force density into existing neighborhoods. You ask any builder about taxes and fees and permit requirements and charges, and he or she will tell you that if they do business in other states, that Washington is one of the toughest places to build and that it's far tougher than it used to be. It is not just regulations and it's not just taxation. It is also restrictions. A third of a century ago, we passed something called the Growth Management Act. Again, a third of a century ago, which requires each county to have its own growth plan. And it also puts a boundary, an urban growth boundary in the county, in this case, East King County, out past Issaquah, that says you can't have density beyond this area. We don't want to encourage sprawl. They have not moved that boundary in a third of a century. And all they can think to do is wag their finger at local government and say, you're not promoting enough density in your communities, therefore we're going to allow sixplexes and condo complexes in your single-family neighborhoods. We're taking away your authority for single-family zoning. The idea of moving the growth boundary out after a third of a century, several miles, just doesn't occur to them. But that just gives you an example of just one thing that matters to a whole lot of people, affordable housing. It's artificially being constricted. And then, of course, the politicians responsible for the problems are now demanding higher taxation and more regulatory authority to make housing affordable. That's how Olympia works in 2023. Monday morning, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Philip J. Vandervoort III standing by. Go for it, Philip J., the Twitter 20.
Well, John, I think there's a high likelihood that you came across this story over the weekend. Probably some of the listeners did as well, but it really seems to facilitate the showdown of the COVID origin story. The Twitter 20, sponsored by the Muckleshoot Casino. All roads lead to Muckleshoot. I'm looking at a version of the story that comes through the New York Times. My understanding is that the Atlantic maybe had been the original source of this reporting. But the headline says, new data links the COVID pandemic origin to raccoon dogs at the Wuhan market in China.
Raccoon dogs.
Raccoon dogs. And I'll get to the raccoon dogs part here in just a moment. But to give the background, the headline or the lead sentence says, an international team of virus experts reported late last week that they had found genetic data from a market in Wuhan, China, linking the coronavirus with raccoon dogs for sale there, adding evidence to the case that the worst pandemic in a century could have been ignited by an infected animal that was being dealt through the illegal wildlife trade. So a week or so ago, we had, well, maybe even a couple of weeks ago, we had the State Department, the U.S. Department of Energy, that was saying their most likely answer was that this stemmed from a leak from a lab or that it originated in a lab. And
that,
now
that,
you've got
the virus appeared to have been engineered.
Yes. So this is now, I think, the response to that Department of Energy report. And I think the FBI had said something similar in testimony to Congress that they felt the most likely outcome would have been that COVID originated in a leak from a lab in Wuhan, China. So now you've got geneticists, according to the New York Times and the Atlantic, that are saying raccoon dogs. I'm a 53-year-old man, John. Never once have I heard the phrase before, raccoon dogs, as it relates to anything, Animal Planet, you know, any sort of animal, wildlife, Nat Geo documentaries. So now all of a sudden, raccoon dogs are coming out of nowhere. I'm thinking this has to have some impact on the latest Guardians of the Galaxy movie with Rocky Raccoon.
That's right. That's where I see the raccoon dog. So the news that's been bubbling toward the surface throughout the weekend is that Donald Trump is facing imminent arrest in New York City, supposedly for violating state laws related to a payment that he approved of back in the fall of 2016 to avoid public embarrassment over a tryst with a porn star. All right. We know this is going to, we have an idea that this is going to happen because Donald Trump himself, trying to get ahead of the story, said, I'm going to be arrested. And this is all a vendetta. This is a political attack, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the thing. Trump's right. This case is so bogus. It's so ridiculous. And by the way, previous investigations into this matter both resulted in no charges being brought for a felony or even a misdemeanor. But this new prosecutor, his name is Alvin Bragg. He is one of those George Soros progressive prosecutors. So a lot of people arrested for violent crimes aren't even being given bail, but he's ready to throw the book at Donald Trump. Now, let's unpack this because it tells you, again, just how politicized the justice system has become. Alvin Bragg is trying to prosecute a federal case in state court. Why is he trying to prosecute a federal case in state court? Because the federal government rejected the case years ago. 5 years ago, this issue was being looked at when Trump was still president as a federal case, and it was set aside. So now, in 2023, a prosecutor, Alvin Bragg, is trying to say that it's a state case. So here's what happened. You'll recall, or maybe you won't, I wouldn't blame you if you didn't, that about a decade ago, Donald Trump reportedly paid a exotic dancer and porn star, her name is Stormy Daniels, paid her $130,000 in the fall of 2016 lest she spill the beans about a tryst that they had had, again, a few years previous. They are trying to say that Trump doing that violated campaign laws, election laws. Now, as it turns out, this was looked into by the New York U.S. attorney. His name is Cyrus Vance Jr., and you might recall Cyrus Vance Jr. used to work for the U.S. Attorney's Office right here in Seattle. And then he left to go work in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York and got the top job. Cyrus Vance is very much a Democrat. His father was Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State. They rejected a prosecution based on the flimsiness of the case. The head of the Federal Elections Commission, the chair of the commission, also expressed doubts about moving forward. And then prosecutors working under Alvin Bragg's predecessor, again, Cyrus Vance Jr., also rejected using New York state law. So both federal and state investigators in New York have already examined this case and already rejected it. But a couple of activist prosecutors in that office continued to insist that Donald Trump should be brought up on these charges. So Alvin Bragg takes office, and he expressed doubts about the case. So a year ago, this thing was shut down. But then one of those activist prosecutors who had resigned from the office in protest wrote a book saying that he thought Donald Trump was guilty in his mind. Again, this according to Jonathan Turley, a law professor at George Washington University and a Democrat himself, and was clearly trying to change the mind of the prosecutor, the head prosecutor, Alvin Bragg. Well, the kerfuffle over the book succeeded. The campaign to try Donald Trump on state charges ended up succeeding, and so Bragg has caved in, and now they're going to try Trump after all. So this is, you know, if you want to get tickled, this falls under what is called Section 175, Donald Trump accused of falsifying business records based on the claim that Trump used legal expenses to conceal the hush money payment to Stormy Daniels, which was a violation of federal law. But again, federal prosecutors have looked at this and already said no. It's not something we could bring. You'll notice that Hillary Clinton was not brought up on federal charges when the Clinton campaign was caught funding the Steele dossier and then calling it a legal expense. That was not charged. And yet now there is this demand that this happened. Now, the other thing that's interesting is that a charge under Section 175 for falsifying business records would normally be a misdemeanor. So they're trying to inflate it into a Class E felony, which has to show, quote, the intent to defraud includes an intent to commit another crime or aid or conceal the commission thereof. And I'm guessing, and Jonathan Turley certainly believes this, that that other crime would probably be the federal elections violation. But here's the other thing. The New York State Prosecutor's Office ran out of time. The statute of limitations ran out of time years ago on charging this as what it's usually charged as a misdemeanor. But if it's charged as a felony, then they still have a few more months to do it under statute of limitations. So that's what they're doing. And this is just pathetic. It's not going to go anywhere. The interesting part about this is the political angle. Does this hurt Donald Trump? An indictment would certainly hurt most politicians, but will it hurt Trump, or does it play right into Donald Trump's narrative that the Democrats have thoroughly politicized the legal system and are using it as a weapon? Because it sure looks that way. Whether you like or dislike Donald Trump, this looks so much like everybody who is in Trump world complains about the double standards of our system. So we'll see where the political fallout goes. But Trump will apparently not be arrested tomorrow, as he had predicted, though he could be subject to arrest on this ridiculous charge, which is going to go nowhere, later this week. And Lars Larson, our noon to three host. Lars, we were just talking about the flimsiness of the case that is expected to be brought against Donald Trump later this week in New York.
And people should understand just how flimsy it is that Alvin Bragg, who's highly political, can't stand Trump, is now, you know, the elected DA of New York City, and he's decided to bring a charge that probably is past the statute of limitations, number one. Number two is a misdemeanor. The false reporting is a misdemeanor, but he's going to somehow try to make it a federal campaign charge, even though an awful lot of other federal campaigns do the same thing. They pay a fine. That's that. But he wants to bring a charge, and he wants to make it into a major case against Trump. So I think Trump took a warning shot across his bow and said, hey, they're going to arrest me Tuesday. You know, John, how long have we been hearing that Donald Trump's imminent indictment was coming just within minutes, and then we hear he's going to be arrested all the way back to Mar-a-Lago? And does anybody even remember Mar-a-Lago? Right after that, it was like, well, this must indicate that Trump's about to be indicted. Nothing has happened. I think what's happened is the people inside the system who hate Donald Trump with a passion have decided to tease right up to the line.
They put out the press release.
They don't actually do it.
Yeah, and then they realize they don't have the case to make. And by the way, this was looked at by both federal and state authorities. Yep. This very issue was looked at and they rejected it. They said, no, we ain't got nothing here.
When Bragg was in the office, mm-hmm. So he was in the DA's office. He wasn't the DA, but he was in the office.
Cyrus Vance was.
He was one of those involved in making the decision. There's no case here. So why are they doing this now? Politics. Pure politics. And note that we are now getting closer and closer to finding the full extent of the Biden crime family's involvement, which really is a clear and present danger to America. We've got a sold-out president.
Now, I know we've got 45 seconds left. We got to talk about this. This is so funny. Hillary Ronan, a San Francisco councilwoman, they call them supervisors down there, called for the defunding of police just 3 years ago. And it was last week she was pounding the podium demanding more police protection for her district because crime is out of control.
Proof positive that Frank Rizzo's old adage that a conservative is a liberal who has been mugged. It sounds like Hillary got mugged, or her neighborhood did anyway.
Someone who is close to you is in fact giving off telltale signs. Call them dog whistles, if you will. of their own deep-seated racism and sexism.
This sounds like it goes beyond microaggression.
Yes. How to tell if your wife or mom or you is a racist? Does she believe in keeping a clean kitchen?
That's the standard now.
If she does, then Professor Jenna Drenton from Loyola University in Chicago, by the way, in their business school faculty.
This is Professor Denton?
Yes, Professor Jenna Drenton.
Drenton with a DR, okay.
In their business school.
Huh.
Who says that she shows how social media platforms present new opportunities for consumers to express their identities and navigate life transitions. This includes multiple facets of digital consumer culture, monetization, gender and identity, from individual consumer behavior to systemic macro level structures, et cetera, et cetera.
Ooh, sounds like strong academia there.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Sounds like blah, blah. Sounds like gobbledygook.
Word salad.
However, she's very concerned about what she calls pantry porn.
I'm sorry, you said porn? Pantry porn. Okay. Does this relate to what people post on social media, maybe?
If you keep a clean kitchen, then it is a sign that you are tied to institutions with a history of classist, racist, and sexist social structures.
Ooh, okay.
So we got ourselves another garden variety Marxist here, hiding behind the term social structure.
Yeah.
Quote from her, cleanliness has historically been used as a cultural gatekeeping mechanism to reinforce status distinctions based on a vague understanding of niceness. Nice people with nice yards in nice houses make for nice neighborhoods. Actually, that's true. Nice people tend to keep nice yards. People tend to make the neighborhood a nicer place. Do you get the feeling that no one who is a neighbor of Jenna Drenton thinks she's not nice?
It would be interesting to see her house, a place of residence, if it's apartment, condo, what have you. If she keeps a clean place or does not.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Well, first of all, I doubt it. I don't think she'd be criticizing something she's doing.
Yeah.
But again, quote, this is Professor Jenna Drenton from Loyola. What lies beneath the surface of this anti-messiness, pro-niceness stance is a history of racist and sexist social structure. Oh, boy. So here's what drives her nuts. It drives her nuts that there are all these postings on social media about how to have a perfectly appointed and organized kitchen and pantry, and that almost all of these videos are posted by
Ladies? Yeah.
Okay. By women. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is what drives a left-wing feminist nuts, when women aren't making the choices that they want them to make. So, of course, you not only ridicule and mock them, if necessary, you need to start slurring them. You need to start slandering and insulting them. And that's what's going on here. Quote, again, from this Loyola professor, magazines like Good Housekeeping were once the brokers of idealized domestic work. Now, online pantry porn sets the aspirational standard for becoming an ideal mom, ideal wife, and ideal woman. This grew out of a shift toward an intensive mothering ideology that equates being a good mom with time-intensive, labor-intensive, financially expensive care work. In other words, now she's upset that some women don't want to go out in the workaday world with her, so they can join her for white wine at 5 o'clock at the nearby bistro, and instead are spending all their time with children and family.
Oh, yeah.
So
patriarchal, right?
So it is. The obvious question is Mrs. Vandervoort,
oh my goodness,
an institutionalized racist and sexist
based on this University of Chicago Loyola?
And don't dodge the question.
Professor, by all means, my wife would be. My wife wants to have a very clean kitchen, and we just remodeled.
Racist!
I've talked off and on about our remodel project
sexist
stuff over the last year. And so, yeah. And the other follow-up question I'd have for this professor is, do you ever go out to eat at a restaurant? And if so, are you even moderately concerned about how clean or dirty the restaurant kitchen is if you're going out to eat? You'd think that if you're going out to eat as a restaurant customer, you'd want to have a restaurant that has a kitchen that's pretty clean, if not really clean.
So now, again, keeping a clean kitchen is not a sign of being, you know, fastidious, but instead now is a sign of being racist, which means prove to Professor Drenton you're not a racist. Be a slob. And keep a messy and a disordered kitchen. Just throw stuff in the pantry like I do. And that's what I'm doing. Oh, I've got this nailed. Whenever Lisa complains, I'll say, honey, I'm showing I'm anti-racist.
How come you didn't
not engaging in pantry porn?
Yeah, how come you didn't wipe up the counter? How come you just threw things into the cupboard? And they're knocked
maybe
over.
Maybe because I'm not hostage to the patriarchy, honey.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it.
I mean, this is a direct parallel to either academicians or social activists in the last couple of years that have tried to complain about punctuality.
Yeah.
And if you show up on time that this is somehow a sign of white supremacy and it's oppressive.
It's a sign of whiteness to be on time.
Yeah.
It's a sign of whiteness to believe in the work ethic. Again, this is not what I say. This is what progressives say. So to show that we are not engaging in a culture that is just an overlay of white supremacy, we need to stop emphasizing things like being punctual and being on and working hard,
keeping a clean kitchen,
and in this case, keeping a clean. see how ridiculous
cupboard
this has gotten.
Yeah.
By the way, what we were saying about what is whiteness, which by the way strikes me as incredibly stereotypical and incredibly racist to assume that these are qualities that are tied to race rather than tied to personal habits or culture.
Sure, yeah.
But
or just this individual values.
This is a Saturday Night Live skit.
Practically, yeah.
A college professor who is complaining about other women being incredibly efficient and well-organized and alleging that their cleanliness and their sense of putting things in order and being able to pack things in an orderly, efficient way is really tied to racism. It's really tied to sexism.
Yeah, you can definitely see the subtext here that this professor that's going down this path really does not like anyone who's going to devote a lot of time and attention to their living circumstances or their organizational circumstances within their home.
It again, I've been telling people for years, the problem with the left is that leftists politicize everything. Everything is political, including, I guess, whether you organize your kitchen pantry in an impressive way. If you do, then it is a sure sign that you are rooted in racist and sexist dogma.
Yeah, and I guess the other parallel here is that for so many examples on the political left, if it comes down to a matter of political disagreement, then the answer must be because your political opponent is racist.
Well, no, that's how you...
Or has some inherent racist tendency.
When you're losing a debate or you can't debate, that's what you do. You throw out name-calling. You throw out slander and slur to say, doesn't matter what this person says because they're racist, so don't even listen to them.
Yeah.
I mean, again, that's how the left engages in debate. They run from debate and call names over their shoulder.
They certainly try to...
This reminds me of Ibram Kendi after...
The anti-racist author. Right.
Yes. After Amy Coney Barrett was nominated to the Supreme Court, there were a number of articles about who she was. And who she was a Roman Catholic mother of, I believe, it was either five kids or seven kids. But she and her husband adopted two children from Haiti. Who were living in an orphanage. There had been a terrible earthquake, and a lot of kids were living in dire straits. Anyway, Ibram Kendi, when told, the anti-racist author, when told that Amy Coney Barrett and her husband had adopted two children, obviously black children, from Haiti... he didn't say, oh, you know, I might disagree with her legal views, or I might disagree with her politics, or I might disagree with her philosophically, but what a humane, compassionate thing to do. You know, open your family to these two children. No, no, he accused her of being a colonizer. A colonizer, because she dared allowed someone who wasn't like her to join her family, bring these children into her family. Again, that is how the left thinks all the time.
And we just had a listener, Art in Issaquah, chime in on the KVI text line, the number 206-421-5757, if you want to text. And Art asked, what about this professor's gradebook? Is that gradebook organized?
By the way, Twitter 20 right around the corner. But right now, our friend KVI weekend host Todd Herman with this morning's ThoughtCast. 7 o'clock, time for Philip J. Vandervoort III and the Twitter 20.
Yes, the Twitter 20, sponsored by the Muckleshoot Casino. All roads lead to Muckleshoot. I want to follow up on what I was talking about on Friday's show here in the 7 o'clock hour. About what we discovered last Friday morning at this time from the writer-journalist Matt Taibbi and the latest Twitter files revelations. And what he was writing about last week was that Stanford University had something called the Virality Project that was essentially suppressing social media posts and content that was related to COVID-19 vaccines, anything related to COVID-19. And I got curious after this story broke basically last Friday morning. I wanted to see, is ABC News, NBC News, CBS News, what other news outlets are going to pick up on this reporting that Matt Taibbi unveiled last Friday morning? And maybe not to my astonishment, I DVR'd the ABC and NBC evening news last Friday. Watch those newscasts. Neither one of them, Lester Holt, David Meir on ABC News, neither one of those newscasts mentioned it. CBS News was preempted because they had basketball NCAA Final Four March Madness coverage. But I did some searches on the biggest search engines going on the internet, Bing.com. The only stories that come up related to what Matt Taibbi reported last week about the Virality Project and how Stanford University was kind of coordinating the censorship for any social media posts on Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube, Google, Twitter, Facebook. The Washington Times, right-leaning news website, Reason.com, a libertarian one, Fox News, we know Fox News, and maybe a couple of others. But there are no stories about the Stanford Virality Project that Matt Taibbi discovered and reported on last week from the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times. None of the other New York newspapers, well, with the exception of the New York Post, but like the Daily News or something like that. So I went to Yahoo. I went to Google. Same situation. No one else is reporting on this. So because it does not fit narrative.
That's why shows like this exist.
Well, exactly. Because it does not fit this narrative. All these legacy news media outlets are completely ignoring this Matt Taibbi story and this revelation that there was a coordinated effort to censor people who said things that the CDC, the likes of Dr. Anthony Fauci, the likes of the Biden administration, the likes of the Governor Jay Inslee administration here in this state did not want people to have that viewpoint or those conclusions. So this censorship is even more broad now that other news outlets are basically ignoring and refusing to report on this story.
Back in 2015, Seattle City Council passed an ordinance that was finally going to get serious about gun violence. The ordinance would tax people, you would impose a special tax on the sale of each firearm and each piece of ammunition to raise about $500,000 every year to fight gun violence. But more to the point, would also send a signal that Seattle will penalize you for wanting to buy a firearm in the first place. So it was a revenue raiser, but it was also a consciousness raiser. It was a way for us to get serious about gun violence because more guns always equals more crime. So if you penalize people for buying guns, that means fewer guns. Maybe it'll mean fewer gun sellers. And that will make for a safer city. That was in 2015. So how's it working? Well, let's deal with the tax take. The first year that the Seattle gun tax went into effect, again, it's $25 for the sale of each firearm, 5 cents for every shotgun shell, 2 cents for each bullet. They did not raise $500,000 or $400,000 or $300,000 or $200,000. They raised barely $103,000. So revenue was about 80% below what we had been told. What's interesting, though, is while revenue was low, homicides began to grow, not shrink. In 2016, there were 19 homicides. And the following year, 2016 was the first full year that the gun tax was in effect. And then the following year, there was 27. Then there were 32. Now we're up to 52. So the number of homicides has more than doubled when the population is about what it was in 2016. Remember, Seattle's been losing population the last couple of years. And the amount of money, again, not 500, not 400. The current yield is, I think, 134,000. Not only that, but as Dave Workman pointed out in his terrific column on this, which is heavily documented, one of the state's leading gun sellers simply left the city and set up shop elsewhere outside Seattle. So they're still selling firearms. They're just not selling firearms in the city. Now, the city of Seattle's reaction to all this is, you know, you can imagine that if gun crime had gone way down and if revenue from this new tax had gone way up, they would have called press conferences. They would have said, here is what we said would happen, but here's what actually happened. Crime way down and revenue way up from the gun tax. Obviously, we're spending this money wisely to stop gun violence. Obviously, we're sending a message out that Seattle is not where you want to come to buy a gun. We are against gun violence in the city of Seattle. These results show how forward-looking we were when we passed this gun tax. You missed that press conference, didn't you? Because I sure did, because it didn't happen. So since the government began to, you know, City Hall began to keep kind of a low profile about this new gun tax, Dave Workman, who is a great journalist, by the way, very much a Second Amendment guy, but a diligent reporter, inquired into how much money was actually being raised, and the city wouldn't tell him. And he finally, after suing the city for violating the State Public Records Act, a King County Superior Court judge agreed with Dave Workman and forced the city to provide the data that embarrassed them. Again, they've never come even close to anywhere the revenue that they were, the numbers they were throwing out there. But the more interesting part to me is the crime data that after passing this anti-gun violence tax, as I pointed out, the number of people who have been killed in Seattle, there were 19 homicides. Now there are 52 homicides. But what about people who are wounded? What about the reports of shots being fired in the first place? Well, in 2016, the first year that the gun tax went into effect in the city of Seattle, there were reports of 265 shots fired. And 62 people were wounded. Now, this is 62 people who showed up at the hospital wounded. There are a lot of other people wounded who, if it wasn't serious, they simply didn't go to Harborview. But that was the number. 265 shots fired, reports of shots fired in 2016, 62 people wounded. In 2022, there were not 265 reports of shots fired. There were 739. Almost triple the number of shots fired in 2016. Keep in mind, the population of Seattle is about today what it was then. And the reports of shots fired have almost tripled. And speaking of tripling, the number of people wounded has gone from 62 to 157 who have shown up at area hospitals within the city of Seattle, wounded. So that's well over double, not quite tripled. So you could almost make the case that by making it harder to buy a firearm, by increasing the expense of purchasing ammunition, which again, when it comes to purchasing a gun, only law-abiding people could do that. They put you through a background check. Uh, that it made the city less safe. Now, I'm not going to say that that's the reason Seattle's crime is soaring. I think the fact that we're not prosecuting criminal activity in the first place, that we have, for all intents and purposes, legalized hard drugs and destigmatized hard drugs and have embraced, the city of Seattle has embraced drug culture. And don't be surprised when heroin, meth, and fentanyl are legal, that there's going to be a huge uptick in violent crime. But it does go to show that the Seattle approach, which is, you know, not just the Seattle City Council, but the Alliance for Gun Responsibility, that approach abysmally failed to hold down crime. In fact, the entire gun control agenda over the last half dozen years that has resulted in a couple of initiatives passing, that hasn't brought down gun violence either, because they're not addressing the root of gun violence. The root of gun violence are violent criminals. You focus your attention on them, that's how you bring down gun violence. You focus your attention on repeat criminals, whether they're armed or not. Repeat criminals, start cracking down. If they are armed, then crack down even harder. If someone steals a gun, if you tripled the penalty for stealing a firearm, there'll be fewer firearms stolen. If you dramatically increase the penalties on felons in possession, illegally possessing a handgun, there'll be fewer felons running around with firearms. Isn't that a good thing? In Seattle, no. Much better to restrict and regulate the activities of law-abiding gun owners. And as we saw with the gun tax, it does not buy you safer streets. It is coming up here on 48 minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning on the Commute with Carlson Talk Radio 570 KVI. The long-term care tax that was set aside may be about to come back. We'll get into that and other terrible ideas in Olympia. Remember that long-term care tax that was so unpopular they decided to put it aside for the indefinite future? Well, the indefinite future ends at the end of June. Carlene Johnson from our sister station, KNWN Northwest News, reports a bill to end it once and for all went nowhere, which means the tax is very much alive.
That means starting in July, you'll see less in your paycheck as the state takes 58 cents for every $100 you make. Governor Jay Inslee says the program is critical as a safety net.
We know that 7 in 10 Washingtonians over the age of 65 will need long-term care.
There was a window to opt out of the tax by showing you got your own long-term care policy, but that window was closed. Glenn Morgan with We the Governed says there are so many flaws with the program.
If you retire in the next 10 years, you get nothing, because you're required to pay at least 10 years into this program before you get the first penny. Tough luck for you, you get nothing.
Elizabeth Hovde at Washington Policy Center also points out the 58 cents for every $100 will certainly increase over time. The payroll tax for paid family and medical leave has already doubled. Carlene Johnson, Northwest News Radio.
Yep, it will only get worse. That's why we need to end it entirely by referendum if necessary. So great having you here, letting me be part of the commute. And as you know, this day, this time of day, 8:05 to 8:15, we focus on a piece of legislation in Olympia that is either so good or so bad that it commands your immediate attention. And your immediate attention should be trained on calling the legislative hotline, which just opened a few minutes ago, and saying that you want a particular bill to pass or a particular bill to fail. We are going through this every day of session until its conclusion with Randy Pepl from shiftwa.org, which is the best website on Washington state politics. Again, that's shiftwa.org. And Randy Pepl is with me this morning. Randy, how are you?
I'm doing well this morning, John.
You're underwater. We can barely hear you.
Okay, is that better?
That is a whole lot better, Randy Pepl. All right. It's going to be a busy week in Olympia this year, or this week.
Well, it will be a busy week. And frankly, the next 4 weeks will be as they start to determine what they're going to inflict upon us. because today they're going to find out what the budget is going to be, because the state revenue budget forecast will come out and will tell us how much money the Democrats are going to spend. And they'll spend all of it, but they have to be told what all means. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. But today in the House,
yep.
In the Community Safety Committee, they're hearing Senate Bill 5536, and we've talked about this before, John. This is the so-called Blake fix, you know, that the state Supreme Court ruled back in 2021 that, you know, drug possession was pretty much legal. Unless the police could prove that you knowingly possessed the 10 pounds of heroin that you had, you know, it was okay.
Well, and, by the way, I should point out that most drug laws in America, most statutes say on possession, say knowingly possess. So that if you're, you know, renting someone's house and you didn't know that, you know, behind a cupboard somewhere, you know, that there was a marijuana stash, that won't be on you. But the bottom line is all they needed to do was add that one word, knowingly, to knowingly possess, a one-word fix was all that was required. And instead, the legislature responded by essentially legalizing all hard drugs, and we've seen what the results have been.
And they've been fighting any change to it ever since, John. And we have seen in the last 2 years the type of drug crime impacts. In not just in our downtown areas, but in all our communities in the state. And yet the Democrats refuse to make that simple fix.
Yeah.
And fortunately, the state Senate, the Republicans worked in the state Senate to pass a bill that passed out with minority Democrat support. I mean, the Democrat Senate did not provide majority support for the bill, 5536. And that's right. Because it didn't include the felony provision. And that's what really needs to happen today. And our listeners, this is the last chance to tell the Democrats, you know what, if you knowingly have heroin, that's a felony. If you knowingly have methamphetamine, that should be a felony. And right now it's treated as a gross misdemeanor. They think that just moving it up to a gross misdemeanor is enough.
Right. Well, basically, Jay Inslee, when I interviewed him, said that he thought gross misdemeanor was sufficient, because it's a big jump up from right now, which is that when you catch someone with fentanyl, the officer has to give them a brochure. Can't arrest them, gives them a brochure, which is, quote, recommend or rather referring someone to services. So Mary Robnett, who is the Pierce County prosecutor, and a bunch of other prosecutors have prevailed on the legislature. Please make hard drug possession a felony, because it will enable us to force more addicts into treatment. Right now, the reason why they're not getting treatment is that it's so easy for them to stay on the streets and remain an addict. And this bill, you know, which 21 days of incarceration on your second conviction, this does nothing. This doesn't help us. But Inslee will probably split the baby. He's got a chance to be Solomon, and he's going to split the baby and say, well, you know, it's harder than it was. I'm moving in that direction. He's just not moving in that direction in any meaningful way, Randy Pepl.
Of course. And here's the chance. If you're going to fix the bill, John, fix it.
Yeah.
And that's what the Democrats will not do by making it a felony in these obvious situations. And, you know, in the Senate, they were arguing over amendments of whether, you know, the suspect had meaningful engagement with their compliance with their treatment.
Again, they're using a lot of wiggle room language. You nailed it. That's exactly what they are doing.
And instead of just making it clear and providing the prosecutors, the professionals, with the tools to try to encourage people into treatment. And sometimes that takes a stick. And the stick is the, hey, do you want a felony? And, you know, do you want a misdemeanor is not the same type of stick, John.
No kidding. That is exactly right. So, Randy Pepl, what do we want people to do today?
You want them to call in because Senate Bill 5536 is in the House. Because remember, now we're only dealing with bills that have passed one of the bodies of the legislature. So even though it's a Senate bill, you want your listeners to be calling in and saying vote no or vote yes on 5536, but amend it to make drug possession a felony.
So this is one of those rare cases where we're telling people to call in support of a bill, but add a message saying amend it. Hard drugs should equal felony. Again, hard drug equal sign, felony. So again, call the legislative hotline at 800-562-6000. Again, that is 800-562-6000. And say you want Senate Bill SB 5536. That's 5536 to pass. But amend it. Make hard drugs a felony. Make hard drugs a felony on SB 5536. Randy Pepl, thanks very much for joining us this morning on The Commute with Carlson.
Thank you, John.
You bet. And we will be talking with Randy Pepl again tomorrow. Again, sometimes we'll tell you a bill you should support, a bill you should oppose. In this case, a bill that you should support if it is amended to make hard drug possession a felony. It should be. They'll do everything they can not to because they don't really want to fix this problem. Again, the majority party does not want hard drug possession to be a felony. It needs to be, or the fentanyl keeps flowing. Why wouldn't it? All right. I don't know if you're a big fan of Shark Tank, but Kevin O'Leary, one of the most astute economic investors in this country, made an appearance and a regular panelist on the Shark Tank program where you pitch these investors to underwrite your investment. He was appearing on CNN's morning show talking to Don Lemon and Poppy Harlow about the states that he will and won't invest in. Very interesting. Have a listen.
I don't put companies here in New York anymore, or in Massachusetts, or in New Jersey, or in California. Those states are uninvestable. The policy here is insane. The taxes are too high. We put them in Fargo, North Dakota, because 40% of the people work elsewhere, including Boston. So I was, you know, of a bit of a debate with Elizabeth Warren about this, but I say, look, Senator, we've got to move the companies out of your state because you're not investable anymore. You're punishing people if they're successful. You overtax them. You hit them with a super tax. New Jersey, what a mess. New York, uninvestable.
Wait, California. Why is New York uninvestable?
Try and do a project in New York. Try and build
Yeah, I'm asking, Don's point, is it beyond the taxes?
Oh, the regulatory environment is punitive. I had a project in upstate New York behind the grid in Niagara Falls for electricity, a global data center we were building. Eventually, it got so bad with the politicians in the local region and the state policy, we moved it to Norway and all the jobs. Wow. Norway has it now. Thousands of jobs coming out of that. I mean, that's New York, uninvestable. Sorry, don't shoot the messenger, just telling you the way it is.
And why wouldn't that apply to Washington State at this point? Why wouldn't that apply to Washington State, where we are increasingly moving toward punitive taxation, attempt to get the camel's nose under the tent on the income tax issue by taxing capital gains investment income and trying to pretend that it's not someone's property? And the income you make from investments is not your property. That is one thing they are doing. Then there's the wealth tax, which is still moving ahead in the legislature. Then there's the regulatory environment, which is especially meddlesome. Washington State ain't far behind California and New York, which is seeing an exodus of people, far more people moving out than moving in.
Those states are uninvestable.
And what do those states have in common?
These are all deep blue states.
Well, that, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, California, state income taxes.
State income taxes.
And Jay Inslee wants a state income tax here.
And high levels of taxation. And high levels of regulation. And where are they moving, by the way? They're moving to Texas. They're moving to Florida, which don't have a state income tax and which have a far better regulatory climate. People I know who've set up shop, who started businesses or relocated businesses to both Florida and Texas report this. Again, this ain't tough. Okay? This is real simple to see. The trend is unmistakable. And Washington State is on the wrong side. It is Philip J. Vandervoort III's favorite segment of the day, social media from Socialists.
Yes, Tears for Fears, rocking those curly-haired mullets back in the day. The Twitter 20, sponsored by the Muckleshoot Casino. All roads lead to Muckleshoot. This one's got some delicious irony to it, John. This is a King 5 story that Eric Wilkinson, their fine reporter, put together.
Oh, yeah.
The headline says, Bellingham looks to therapeutic court to tackle downtown problems. The cut line, Bellingham is considering fighting crime with compassion.
Yeah, that's working well.
Tell me how that's been going so far. And
no, they're using the, basically, it's unbelievable that Bellingham City Council looks at what Seattle has become in the last few years and said, how can we emulate that? Yeah, how can we bring that to Bellingham?
That seems to be the case. The King 5 story starts off talking to a judge, and it's the city of Bellingham judge, so a municipal judge, Deborah Lev. She says, jail is not the answer. She's been a municipal court judge for 21 years. For more than a decade, King 5 says Judge Lev has been envisioning a court where jail is a last resort for low-level offenders. Rehabilitation is the road to redemption.
Has been for years.
And then it goes on to say, Bellingham city leaders are proposing a therapeutic court that would place nonviolent offenders in drug or other counseling with wraparound services for housing and employment instead of jail.
Well, no one's thought of that yet.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much where Seattle's at. The program would be run out of the Bellingham Municipal Court, where the vast majority of cases are related to drug, mental health, and homelessness issues.
How long has she been this dumb?
She's been a judge for 21 years on the municipal court in
Bellingham. And she's learned nothing.
Apparently so.
And apparently she doesn't appear to make any distinction between first-time offenders and serial, habitual, repeat offenders.
The King 5 story says if defendants fail to complete their conditions, they could be sentenced to jail, but more likely to community service. Judge Lev says, quote, we want to connect the individual to the community so they see it matters that they're a member of the community, end quote.
Will someone please tell this woman it's not 2004?
Yeah.
What an idiot.
Yeah, the King 5 story says the proposal.
When you ignore everything that's going on around you, you know, you're either completely clueless or you're completely indifferent to what we've learned from what's been going on.
The King 5 story says the proposal comes as some in Washington state say cities are becoming too soft on crime. To that, Judge Lev responded, quote, it's a proven model. We've seen it work in our domestic violence and wellness programs. It has worked in King County and across the country, end quote.
Tell me where in King County this is where. Yeah. Tell me where. Is Seattle your example of where this is working really well?
That seems to be what she's inferring.
Well, you know, she can imply what she wants, but the bottom line is no, that is not what experience is teaching Seattle. What they are teaching is that when there are no consequences, the behavior continues. And wait a minute now, the behavior expands because other people decide, hey, I can get into this as well, which is why Seattle is such a popular place for people to move to if they want to do hard drugs. So down in Seattle's South Park neighborhood, South Park is an area where it's largely thought of, you know, as an industrial area, and, you know, Boeing is there on the west side, but there's pockets of homes and neighborhoods, and they have been inundated for years with homeless RVs, i.e. rolling drug dens that have broken down, and there's the tents and the proverbial homeless drug encampments, and they are finally getting rid of them. Here's one man who's been living there, what he had to say.
Everybody down here has got some disability. Nobody says they want to come down here and be destitute.
Okay, the disability is addiction to drugs. Mental health issues are definitely a part of that. Now, Jonathan Cho has made it his mission to tell people what's happening at ground level in Seattle. Never mind the press releases, never mind the press conferences and the media tours. He'll say, here's what's really going on. He says that this planned cleanup of South Park is, quote, the sweep of the year. He says, I haven't seen anything like this before. So let's check in with Jonathan Cho and find out why. You can see his great stuff. Listen to his great stuff on Twitter. He's also at discovery.org. That's discovery.org. Good morning, Jonathan Cho.
Hey, good morning, John.
So tell us why what you're seeing there is unlike anything you've seen this year.
Well, it's simply because the area of land that this encampment covers, but also the number of burned out and stolen vehicles and RVs. I mean, SPD's essentially called this area a chop shop and a dumping ground for stolen cars. So it is truly a sight to behold. You have to be here, John, to really understand and appreciate the magnitude of this. Now, there are, at this point, fewer than, you know, maybe three or four people left who are kind of the stragglers here. The Regional Homelessness Authority, you know, the outreach workers have been, you know, trying to get people into housing for months. The agency right. says around, 30 people have been, you know, put into temporary housing. But, you know, they're folks who have also refused, who have just decided to move to other parts of the city and set up shop again.
So is this an abandoned homeless camp, or are they sweeping the drug addicts and others out of there?
Well, sort of both. This was planned. This is going to be a four-day affair, and I say, this is the sweep of the year, and I've never seen anything like this because, truly, I've never seen anything like this with all the heavy machinery that's going to be required to move out all of these vehicles, again, that have been dumped and abandoned. So the city and the state, and I want to be very clear, this is properties and parcels owned jointly by WashDOT and then Seattle.
Yeah.
So it's been kind of this jurisdictional nightmare of bureaucracy, red tape. And it's taken years now to get to this point. So a lot of neighbors are still skeptical. They say they'll believe it when they see it actually happen. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see. This thing starts at 9 a.m.
Now, in previous sweeps, there's been resistance. There have been people who try and block, activists who try and block people from sweeping the area. What's happening here?
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see any of that today. This thing was planned far in advance, and because so many people have been placed and have accepted transitional housing to some degree. The activists now primarily show up. They set up a table with coffee and donuts. And, you know, if anyone needs help moving around to another part of the city, they'll offer that. But in terms of resistance, I don't expect a protest today.
I want to know what happens when activists set up a table with coffee and donuts and Jonathan Cho walks up and says, sure, I'll have a coffee and donut.
Yeah, I don't get any VIP treatment. I'll just say that.
No. Jonathan, it's very, when you say the size and scope of this, how big? What are the dimensions here?
I mean, just for your audience listening, I'd say it's the size at least of two football fields.
Whoa.
I was there over the weekend, you can easily see at least two parcels just full of abandoned cars, broken down tents, twisted metal. And then you have a bunch of side streets that also have these sweep signs going up, and the state's going to handle those as well. So I've already seen some, you know, campers move to the side streets, and I asked them, "Are you going to stay here?" And they say, "Yeah, until we get moved." So we'll see what happens. But this is again a 4-day affair. It's going to take some time, but it's going to be a sight to behold with all the heavy machinery going in, trying to get all these vehicles out.
Okay, two things. The first is there a reason they can't do that everywhere? Is there a reason why they're not doing this under the Ship Canal Bridge?
That's a great question. I don't have an answer for that. That's a question you're going to have to ask Governor Jay Inslee and WashDOT, because the Ship Canal Bridge and Cabin, that is a state right-of-way.
Yeah.
Now, they've announced, after parents' protests in front of John Stanford Elementary School, where the Ship Canal is directly located right across the street, after a protest this past Friday, the Ship Canal Bridge and Cabin is going to get finally cleared at the end of this month, rather. Problem for WashDOT is they've only cleared 4 encampments. If they clear this First Avenue Bridge encampment, it's going to be 5. Since they announced this right-of-way initiative last year, that's millions of dollars, and they've only now cleared up to potentially 5. That number is just unacceptable.
No, it's abysmal. It really is abysmal. And also, it's something that we're used to seeing is that the people who are living there, who are told to, you know, they refuse the shelter that is offered them, largely because they can't bring drugs with them. And so they simply say, fine, I'll go 2 blocks away and set up shop there. How do you keep that from happening? Is that all, or are the people who are leaving vowing to do that?
They are. And that's what the city and the state, just crews have not figured that out. City leaders, state leaders, they've not figured that out. How do you get in front of an encampment before it spirals out of control? There's no answer for that right now. At least I haven't seen one that's very
clear. There is an answer. You know what the answer is? You are illegally trespassing. You are ordered off the property. If you appear anywhere else in the next 30 days and trespass in a similar way, you will be arrested and subject to an automatic 30-day jail sentence. In other words, you have immediate consequences right up front. We're telling you to leave, and if we catch you going around the corner doing the same thing, we're taking you in. That would dramatically reduce the number of people, addicts especially, who are simply going to another part of town and setting up shop doing the same illegal thing.
John, that seems extremely reasonable. Problem is, folks aren't getting tracked. The city, the state, they really don't have the manpower to do this. Outreach workers with KCRHA say they are, but in terms of actual enforcement, when it comes to the police coming in and having to remove these illegal encampments, SPD's not tracking these people. They don't have the manpower. They don't even have the officers to do that. So that piece is key, yet it's not happening.
I really appreciate you taking us there, letting us know what happened. What do you think is coming next, Jonathan Cho?
I know for a fact that at least from a sweep standpoint, the Ship Canal Bridge encampment is going to be happening at the end of the month. And then there are going to be 2 more in Chinatown that WashDOT's finally targeting. So that's going to be a relief. The key, though, John, is what is WashDOT going to do to prevent these situations from coming back again? They're talking about fencing. The fencing has worked in some other places where they've cleared, so we'll have to wait and see.
All right. Jonathan, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
All right, John, take care.
You got it. That's Jonathan Cho telling us what is different about this particular sweep and how it could have gone so much, how it's going so far and how this could be happening elsewhere in the city. Only the fifth major sweep, and they've been at this for more than a year, and there are dozens and dozens of these illegal drug encampments. You're listening to The Commute with Carlson. I got a question for you. Is your mom or is your wife or are you, a woman listening to The John Carlson Show, are you a racist? There's a way of finding out. There's a tell that you might not have been aware of that's been brought to our attention. Talk Radio 570 KVI Seattle, KPLZ HD3 Seattle. Great having you with me. Is your mom, is your wife, or are you a racist? There is a certain tell, a certain indicator that you might not have been aware of because your consciousness has not been raised to recognize systemic racism when you see it. I'll tell you what it is, un momento. Right now, just wanting to tie a bow on the loop of this long-term care tax story that we've been talking about. Keep in mind, the state decided to pass a long-term care tax, which would hit everybody, but you would pay into it.
Well, everybody that has a job.
Yeah, every employed person. Works. It would be a payroll tax on every person who is working. But if you're within 10 years of retirement, you'll have to pay into it for, let's say, the next 6 or 7 years, and then you're going to retire. And you don't get anything out of it because you have to be enrolled for 10 years.
And do they fix the portability thing that if you move out of state when you retire?
If you move out of state, you lose the benefit. It's not like your 401k or your Social Security that when you leave the state, it travels with you. This benefit does not travel with you. And if you happen to live in, let's say, Oregon, but you're working in Washington, or you live in Idaho, and that you work in the Spokane Valley, no, you don't get this benefit. You're not a Washington State resident. But they'll tax you for the wages you earned in Washington.
If your employer is in Washington, all sorts of trouble.
And the reason why this thing is just racked with difficulty is that it really wasn't set up to care for elderly people with their long-term care needs. The entire lifetime benefit of this long-term care program is $36,000, which you can burn through in less than a year at a long-term care facility. I mean, 6 months in some of them. But anyway, Philip J., you said that you had some additional info about how Jay Inslee got it wrong when he said 70% of people are going to need this.
Yes, I was very dubious of that claim, 70% would need this. I did some sleuthing, and the website for the American Association for Long-Term Care Insurance is AALTCI.org. This would be the industry group that wants to sell you long-term care insurance and ostensibly would be doing everything they can to convince you to buy long-term care insurance.
All right. So
on this page, it says, so many articles refer to a statistic you will not find on our association's website. We are referring to the statistic that, quote, 70% of people over age 65 need some long-term care, end quote. That is what you've played from a clip of Jay Inslee earlier this morning.
Well, that's
on the show.
Mantra. That's what they're saying on the floor of the House and the Senate.
That, in justification for this stupid long-term care tax that Washington is going to
that's
institute.
That's what they're saying.
The insurance company website says this number, based on a government study conducted years ago, may be accurate, but the definition for long-term care is quite encompassing and not relevant to a discussion regarding long-term care insurance utilization.
Well, then that means it's not accurate.
So they're basically saying this is a bogus claim to say 70% of people approaching retirement age will need some type of long-term care. And Governor Inslee is pushing forward another bogus comment, essentially a lie or a misrepresentation, well, however you want to describe that.
No, a lot of people want to, you know, set aside for their long-term care needs, but the government program they have is such a brazen ripoff. And it's because the reason they have this program is to benefit an interest group. The interest group are home health care workers. That's who this whole thing is set up for. That's why when you leave the state, the benefits don't go with you, because there are no Washington state members of the SEIU union working as Washington state home health care workers in Oregon, California, Idaho, Montana, Texas, Arizona, etc. So since the program was written for them, in fact, they probably wrote the bill. That's why you have these bizarre carve-outs. And again, they are going to have to, I believe they have to take a separate vote to authorize this long-term care tax going into effect in June. If they do, and a referendum campaign or an initiative campaign is mounted to take it down, it will succeed. It will definitely succeed. It is such a terrible program, and it's such a terrible
statewide vote. I find it difficult to believe that this would pass. If there was a thorough evaluation and reporting on what this encompasses, and if this was a private insurance company that was saying, hey, we want to sell you a great long-term care insurance policy, but it's limited on how much you can use, and if you move here or there, it's not going to be something that you can use, and they had all these restrictions on portability and so forth. The attorney general in this state, Bob Ferguson, would be quick to sue any private company that tried to pull off such a ripoff.
Oh,
but the state law manages to go forward.
Yeah, no,
go
absolutely. You pay into a program, but unless you pay into it for 10 years, you can't access it. But you still have to pay into it if you're going to retire in, let's say, 5 or 6 years. Again, you think if this were a private program that the state would allow this to happen? Again, it is a misnamed program that is really there to help an interest group. It's not there to help people. Okay. So, I wanted to get to the issue of how to tell if your wife or your mom is a racist or not. The answer comes to us from Loyola Professor Jenna Drenton, who has just posted her theory that if you want to know if the woman in your life is a racist or not, check and see how clean the kitchen is. A clean kitchen is a sign of racism. She's actually saying this out loud. She's posting on this. It bothers her, Professor Drenton, that there are all these videos out there showing different ways to organize kitchen pantries in really impressive ways to get so many products in such self-contained spaces. She points out that many of the people creating these videos are, quote, predominantly white women, close quote, and that a neat kitchen pantry or a neat refrigerator is a new status symbol that replaces the old one of having a nice house. She wrote, and again, I'm quoting here, this comes courtesy of Democratic law professor Jonathan Turley. Cleanliness has historically been used as a cultural gatekeeping mechanism to reinforce social status distinctions based on a vague understanding of niceness. Nice people with nice yards and nice houses make for nice neighborhoods. By the way, isn't that true? Aren't nice people with nice yards and houses usually what you see in a nice neighborhood? But anyway, I digress. She goes on to say, what lies beneath the surface of this anti-messiness, pro-niceness stance is a history of classist, racist, and sexist social structures. She goes on to say, magazines like Good Housekeeping were once the brokers of idealized domestic work. Now, online pantry porn sets the aspirational standard for becoming an ideal mom, ideal wife, and ideal woman. This grew out of a shift toward an intensive mothering ideology that equates being a good mom with time-intensive, labor-intensive, financially expensive care work. In other words, it bothers her that these women aren't slobs. It bothers her that these women are helping other women improve the appearance and the organization of their kitchen pantry or their refrigerator or their spice rack. This annoys her because it points to a history of classist, racist, and sexist social structures. That's right out of Marx, by the way. And it underscores what John Carlson has been telling you now for years. For the political left, everything, everything is political. Even when it comes to a clean and neat and orderly and well-organized kitchen pantry and refrigerator.
We had a listener on the KVI text line, Michael in Gig Harbor, said, this professor at Loyola is one more reason for me to be hyper excited to pay that student debt for all these students that are getting educated by this gal.
Stay tuned for Ari Hoffman, 3 to 6, our good buddy Lars Larson, noon to 3. And right now it's time for another week of Mark Lee, Van Camp, and Robbins.
Are you ready?
Jamie Markley, David Van Camp, and Scott Robbins.
We just become best friends.
Yep.
Making sense of it all.
Now I get it.
And having some fun.
Lighten up, Francis.
This is the Markley, Van Camp, and Robbins Show. All right.
The Markley, Van Camp, and Robbins.